Chapter 4. As he drew near his villa, Mushkin noticed with great surprise that his veranda was brightly lighted up, and that a large and noisy company was assembled there. The party was a merry one, laughing and shouting. They seemed to be arguing at the top of their voices. The first glance suggested that they were having an hilarious time, and when he mounted to the veranda, he found that in fact they'd all been drinking, and drinking champagne, and apparently had been drinking for some time, so that many of the revellers had become very agreeably exhilarated by now. They were all people he knew, but it was strange that they should all have come together at once, as though by invitation, though Mushkin had not invited them, and had only by chance recollected that it was his birthday. "No doubt you told someone you'd uncork the champagne, and so they've all run in," muttered Rogojin, following Mushkin to the veranda. "We know their ways. You've only to whistle to them," he added almost angrily, doubtless recalling his own recent past. They all greeted Mushkin with shouts and good wishes, and surrounded him. Some were very noisy, others much quieter, but hearing that it was his birthday, all in turn hastened to congratulate him. Mushkin was puzzled at the presence of some persons, for instance, Badovsky. But what was most surprising was that Yevgeny Pavlovich turned out to be among them. Mushkin could scarcely believe his eyes, and was almost scared at seeing him. Lebediev, flushed and almost ecstatic, ran up with explanations. He was pretty far gone already. From his babble it appeared that the party had come together quite naturally, and in fact by chance. First of all, towards the evening, Ippolit had arrived, and feeling much better, had expressed the desire to wait for Mushkin on the veranda. He had installed himself on the sofa. Then Lebediev had gone down to join him, and then all his household, that is, his daughters and General Ivolgin. Badovsky had come with Ippolit to bring him. Ganya and Titsin seemed to have called in later, as they passed by, at about the time of the incident in the gardens. Then Keller had turned up, told them it was Mushkin's birthday, and asked for champagne. Yevgeny Pavlovich had only arrived half an hour ago. Kolya, too, had insisted vigorously on their bringing champagne and celebrating the occasion. Lebediev had readily produced the wine.
"But my own," he murmured to Mushkin, "at my own expense to celebrate your birthday and congratulate you. And there'll be some supper, some light refreshments. My daughter is seeing to that. But, Prince, if only you knew the subject they're discussing. Do you remember in Hamlet, to be or not to be? The subject of the day. Questions and answers, and Mr. Terentyev's at the utmost pitch. He won't go to bed, and he's only had a sip of the champagne. It won't hurt him. Come along, Prince, you settle it. They've all been waiting for you, all been waiting for your happy wit."
Mushkin met the sweet and kindly eyes of Vera Lebediev, who was also trying to get to him through the crowd. Passing over the rest, he held out his hand first to her. She flushed with pleasure and wished him a happy life from that day forward. Then she rushed full speed to the kitchen. There she was preparing some supper. But even before Mushkin had arrived, whenever she could tear herself for a minute from her work, she had run out to the veranda and listened, all ears, to the heated discussion that never paused among the exhilarated guests concerning subjects of the most abstract nature, mysterious to her. Her open-mouthed younger sister was asleep on a chest in the next room, but the boy, Lebediev's son, was standing by Kolya and Ippolit, and the look on his eager face showed that he was ready to stand there, listening and enjoying himself for another 10 hours at a stretch.
"I have been waiting particularly to see you, and I'm very glad that you've come in such a happy mood,"
said Ippolit, when Mushkin went up to shake his hand, immediately after Vera's.
"How do you know I'm in a happy mood?"
"One can see it from your face. Finish greeting the company and make haste and sit here. I've been waiting particularly to see you,"
he added, seeming to lay stress on the fact that he had been waiting. In reply to an inquiry from Mushkin whether it were not bad for him to be sitting up so late, he answered that he could not help wondering himself how it was that he had been almost dying 3 days ago, and yet he had never felt better in his life than that evening. Badovsky jumped up from his chair and muttered that he
had only brought Ippolit,
and that he was glad, that he had written nonsense in his letter, but now was simply glad. Without finishing his sentence, he warmly pressed Mushkin's hand and sat down on a chair. Last of all, Mushkin went up to Yevgeny Pavlovich. The latter at once took his arm.
"I have a couple of words to say to you,"
he whispered, "and about a very important circumstance. Let us move aside for a moment."
"A couple of words," whispered another voice in Mushkin's other ear, and another hand took his arm on the other side.
With surprise, Mushkin observed a terribly unkempt figure with a flushed, winking and laughing face, in which he instantly recognized Ferdyshenko, who had turned up from goodness knows where.
"Do you remember Ferdyshenko?" he asked Mushkin.
"Where have you come from?" cried Mushkin.
"He's sorry," cried Keller, running up. "He was in hiding. He didn't want to come out to us. He was hiding in the corner there. He's sorry, Prince. He feels himself to blame."
"But what for? What for?"
"I met him, Prince. I met him just now and brought him along. He is one of the rarest men among my friends, but he's sorry."
"Delighted, gentlemen. Go and sit down with the rest. I'll come directly," said Mushkin, getting away at last and hurrying to Yevgeny Pavlovich.
"It's very interesting here," observed the latter. "I have enjoyed the half hour I've been waiting for you. And look here, dear Lyof Nikolaevich. I've settled everything with Kermashov, and I've come to set your mind at rest. You have no need to be uneasy. He's taking the thing very, very sensibly, especially as to my thinking it was more his fault."
"What, Kermashov?"
"Why, the fellow whose arms you held this afternoon. He was so furious that he meant to come to you for an explanation tomorrow."
"You don't mean it."
"Well, nonsense. Of course it's nonsense, and could only end in nonsense. But these people..."
"You've come about something else too, perhaps, Yevgeny Pavlovich."
"Oh, of course I have," replied the other, laughing. "I'm setting off at daybreak tomorrow, dear Prince, for Petersburg. About that unhappy business, about my uncle, you know. Would you believe it? It's all true, and everybody knew it except me. I feel so overwhelmed by it that I haven't been able to go to them, the Epanchins. I can't go tomorrow either, because I shall be in Petersburg. Do you understand? I may not be here for 3 days, perhaps. In short, things are in a bad way with me. Though the matter is of the utmost importance, yet I decided that I must speak quite openly with you about something, and without delay. That is, before I go. I'll sit and wait, if you like, till your party is broken up. Besides, I've nowhere else to go. I'm so excited that I couldn't go to bed. Moreover, though it's an unconscionable proceeding, and not at all the thing to pursue a man like this, I tell you straight out, I have come to ask for your friendship, my dear Prince. You're a unique sort of person. That is, you don't tell a lie at every turn. Perhaps not at all. And I want a friend and adviser in a certain matter, for there's not a doubt I'm one of the unlucky. Now..." He laughed again.
"The trouble is this," said Mushkin, thinking for an instant. "You want to wait till they have gone, but God knows when that will be. Wouldn't it be better for us to take a walk in the park now? They'll wait for me, of course. I'll excuse myself."
"No, no. I have my own reasons for not letting them suspect that we're talking apart from some object. There are people here who are very inquisitive about our relations with one another. Don't you know that, Prince? And it will be much better if they see that we are on the most friendly terms without any private understanding. Do you understand? They'll break up in another 2 hours. I'll ask you to give me 20 minutes or half an hour then."
"By all means. You are very welcome. I'm delighted to see you without explanations, and thank you for your kind words about our friendly relations. Pardon me for having been inattentive today. Do you know, I somehow can't pay attention just now?"
"I see. I see," muttered Yevgeny Pavlovich with a faint smile. He was ready to laugh at anything that evening.
"What do you see?" said Mushkin, startled.
"But you don't suspect, dear Prince," said Yevgeny Pavlovich, still smiling, and not answering his direct question. "You don't suspect that I've simply come to take you in, and incidentally to get something out of you, eh?"
"That you have come to get something out of me, I have no doubt," said Mushkin, laughing too at last. "And perhaps you have planned to deceive me a little, too. But what of it? I'm not afraid of you. Besides, I somehow don't mind now. Would you believe it? And as I am convinced above all that you're a splendid fellow, we shall perhaps end by really becoming friends. I like you very much, Yevgeny Pavlovich. You are, in my opinion, a thorough gentleman."
"Well, anyway, it's very nice to have to do with you in anything, whatever it may be," said Yevgeny Pavlovich in conclusion. Come, now drink a glass to your health. I'm awfully glad I came to you. Ah, he stopped suddenly. That Mr. Ippolit has come to stay with you, hasn't he?
Yes.
He isn't going to die directly, I imagine.
Why do you ask?
Oh, nothing. I've been spending half an hour with him here. Ippolit had been waiting for Mushkin and watching him and Yevgeny Pavlovich all the while they had been talking aside. He became feverishly excited when they came up to the table. He was uneasy and agitated. Sweat stood out on his forehead. In his glittering eyes could be seen a sort of vague impatience, as well as a continual wandering uneasiness. His eyes strayed aimlessly from object to object, from face to face. Though he took a leading part in the noisy general conversation, his excitement was simply feverishness. He paid little heed to the conversation itself. His arguments were incoherent, ironical, and carelessly paradoxical. He broke off in the middle and did not finish what he had begun with fervent heat. To his surprise and regret, Mushkin learnt that he had been allowed, without protest that evening, to drink two glasses of champagne, and that the glass that stood empty before him was the third. But he learnt this only later. At the moment he was not very observant.
"Do you know, I'm awfully glad that your birthday is today,"
cried Ippolit.
"Why?"
"You'll see. Make haste and sit down. In the first place, because your people have all come here tonight. I'd reckon there'd be a lot of people. For the first time in my life, I've been right in my reckoning. It's a pity I didn't know it was your birthday. I'd have brought you a present. But perhaps I have brought you a present. Is it long till daylight?"
"It's not 2 hours now to sunrise," observed Titsin, looking at his watch.
"What need of daylight when one can read out of doors without it?" remarked someone. "Because I want to see the sunrise. Can we drink to the health of the Sun Prince? What do you think?"
Ippolit spoke abruptly, addressing the whole company unceremoniously, as though he were giving orders, but he was apparently unconscious of doing so himself.
"Let's drink to it, if you like. Only you ought to keep quieter, Ippolit, oughtn't you?" "You're always for sleep. You might be my nurse, Prince. As soon as the sun shows itself and resounds in the sky... Who was it wrote the verse, 'The sun resounded in the sky'? There's no sense in it, but it's good. Then we'll go to bed. Lebediev, the sun's the spring of life, isn't it? What's the meaning of springs of life in the apocalypse? Have you heard of the star that is called Wormwood, Prince?"
"I've heard that Lebediev identifies the star that is called Wormwood with the network of railways spread over Europe."
"Oh, no, excuse me, that won't do," cried Lebediev, leaping up and waving his arms as though he were trying to stop the general laughter that followed. "Excuse me, with these gentlemen, all these gentlemen," he turned suddenly to Mushkin, "I tell you, on certain points, it's simply this." And he rapped the table twice without ceremony, which increased the general mirth. Though Lebediev was in his usual evening condition, he was on this occasion overexcited and irritated by the long and learned discussion that had taken place, and on such occasions he treated his opponents with undisguised and unbounded contempt. "That's not right. Half an hour ago, Prince, we made a compact not to interrupt, not to laugh while anyone was speaking, but to leave him free to express himself, and then let the atheists answer him if they like. We chose the general as president, for else anyone could be shouted down in a lofty idea, a profound idea." "But speak, speak, nobody's shouting you down," cried voices. "Talk, but don't talk nonsense."
"What is the star that is called Wormwood?" asked somebody.
"I haven't the slightest idea,"
answered General Ivolgin, turning with an important air to his former seat as president.
"I'm wonderfully fond of all these arguments and disputations, Prince. Learned ones, of course,"
Keller was muttering meantime, positively fidgeting on his chair with impatience and excitement.
"Learned and political,"
he added suddenly and unexpectedly, addressing Yevgeny Pavlovich, who was sitting almost next to him.
"Do you know, I'm awfully fond of reading in the papers about the English Parliament. I don't mean what they discuss, I'm not a politician, you know, but I like the way they speak to one another and behave like politicians, so to speak. The noble Viscount sitting opposite... The noble Earl, who is upholding my view, my honourable opponent, who has amazed Europe by his proposal. All those expressions, all this parliamentarism of a free people, that's what's so fascinating to people like us. I'm enchanted, Prince. I've always been an artist at the bottom of my soul. I swear I have, Yevgeny Pavlovich.
Why then, cried Ganya hotly in another corner, it would follow from what you say that railways are a curse, that they are the ruin of mankind, that they are a plaque that has fallen upon the earth to pollute the springs of life.
Gavril Ardalionovitch was in a particularly excited state that evening, and in gay, almost triumphant spirits, so Mushkin fancied. He was joking, of course, with Lebediev, egging him on, but soon he got hot himself.
"Oh, not railways, no!"
retorted Lebediev, who was at the same time losing his temper and enjoying himself tremendously.
"The railways alone won't pollute the springs of life, but the whole thing is accursed. The whole tendency of the last few centuries in its general scientific and materialistic entirety is perhaps really accursed."
"Certainly accursed, or only perhaps? It's important to know that, you know," queried Yevgeny Pavlovich.
"Accursed! Accursed, most certainly accursed," Lebediev maintained with heat.
"Don't be in a hurry, Lebediev. You're much milder in the morning," put in Titsin with a smile.
"But in the evening more open. In the evening more hearty and open,"
Lebediev turned to him warmly.
"More open-hearted and definite. More honest and honourable. And although I am exposing my weak side to you, no matter. I challenge you all now. All you atheists, with what will you save the world, and where have you found a normal line of progress for it, you men of science, of industry, of cooperation, of labour wage and all the rest of it? With what? With credit? What's credit? Where will credit take you?"
"Ugh, you are inquisitive," observed Yevgeny Pavlovich.
"Well, my opinion is that anyone who is not interested in such questions is a fashionable chenapan."
"But at least it leads to general solidarity and a balance of interests," observed Titsin.
"That's all. That's all. Without recognising any moral basis except the satisfaction of individual egoism and material necessity. Universal peace, universal happiness from necessity. Do I understand you right, my dear sir? May I venture to ask?"
"But the universal necessity of living, eating and drinking, and a complete scientific, in fact, conviction that these necessities are not satisfied without association and solidarity of interests is, I believe, a sufficiently powerful idea to serve as a basis and spring of life for future ages of humanity," observed Ganya, who was excited in earnest.
"The necessity of eating and drinking? That is merely the instinct of self-preservation."
"But isn't that instinct of self-preservation a sufficient matter? Why, the instinct of self-preservation is the normal law of humanity."
"Who told you that?" cried Yevgeny Pavlovich suddenly. "It's a law, that's true. But it's no more normal than the law of destruction, or even self-destruction. Is self-preservation the whole normal law of mankind?"
"Ha ha!"
cried Ippolit, turning quickly to Yevgeny Pavlovich and scrutinizing him with wild curiosity. But seeing that he was laughing, he too laughed, nudged Kolya, who was standing beside him, and asked him again what o'clock it was, and even took hold of Kolya's silver watch himself and looked eagerly at the hands. Then, as though forgetting everything, he stretched himself on the sofa, placed his arms behind his head, and stared at the ceiling. Half a minute later, he sat down again at the table, drawing himself up and listening to the babble of Lebediev, who was intensely excited.
"An artful and ironical idea, insidious as a larding needle,"
Lebediev greedily caught up Yevgeny Pavlovich's paradox.
"An idea expressed with the object of provoking opponents to battle, but a true idea. For you, a worldly scoffer and cavalry officer, though not without brains, are not yourself aware how true and profound your idea is. Yes, sir. The law of self-destruction and the law of self-preservation are equally strong in humanity. The devil has equal dominion over humanity till the limit of time which we know not. You laugh? You don't believe in the devil? Disbelief in the devil is a French idea, a frivolous idea. Do you know who the devil is? Do you know his name? Without even knowing his name, you laugh at the form of him, following Voltaire's example. His hooves, his tail, his horns, which you have invented. For the evil spirit is a mighty menacing spirit, but he is not the hooves and horns you've invented for him. But he's not the point now."
"How do you know that he's not the point now?"
cried Ippolit suddenly, and laughed as though in hysterics.
"A shrewd and insinuating thought,"
Lebediev approved.
But again, that's not the point. The question is whether the springs of life have not grown weaker with the increase of railways, cried Collier. Not railway communication, young but impetuous youth, but all that tendency of which railways may serve, so to speak, as the artistic pictorial expression. They hurry with noise, clamour and haste, for the happiness of humanity, they tell us. Mankind has grown too noisy and commercial. There is little spiritual peace, one secluded thinker has complained. So be it. But the rumble of the wagons that bring bread to starving humanity is better, maybe, than spiritual peace, another thinker, who is always moving among his fellows, answers him triumphantly and walks away from him conceitedly. But vile as I am, I don't believe in the wagons that bring bread to humanity. For the wagons that bring bread to humanity, without any moral basis for conduct, may coldly exclude a considerable part of humanity from enjoying what is brought. So it has been already. The wagons can coldly exclude, someone repeated. And so it has been already, repeated Lebedev, not deigning to notice the question. We've already had Malthus, the friend of humanity. But the friend of humanity with shaky moral principles is the devourer of humanity, to say nothing of his conceit. For wound the vanity of any one of these numerous friends of humanity, and he's ready to set fire to the world out of petty revenge. Like all the rest of us, though, in that, to be fair. Like myself, vilest of all, for I might well be the first to bring the fuel and run away myself. But that's not the point again.
What is it, then?
You're boring us! The points lie in what follows. In an anecdote of the past, for I absolutely must tell you a story of ancient times. In our times, and in our country, which I trust you love, gentlemen, as I do, for I am ready to shed the last drop of my blood for...
Get on, get on!
In our country, as well as in the rest of Europe, widespread and terrible famines visit humanity, as far as they can be reckoned, and as far as I can remember... not oftener now than 4 times a century. In other words, every 25 years. I won't dispute the exact number, but they are comparatively rare.
Compared to what?
Compared with the 12th century, or those near it, before or after. For then, as they write and as writers assert, widespread famines came usually every 2 years, or at least every 3 years, so that in such a position of affairs, men even had recourse to cannibalism, though they kept it secret. One of these cannibals announced, without being forced to do so, as he was approaching old age, that in the course of his long and needy life, he had killed and eaten by himself, in dead secret, 60 monks and a few infant laymen, a matter of 6, but not more. Well, that is extraordinarily few, compared with the immense mass of ecclesiastics he had consumed. Grown-up laymen, it appeared, he had never approached with that object.
"That can't be true,"
cried the President himself, the General, in an almost resentful voice.
"I often reason and dispute with him, gentlemen, always about such things, but usually he brings forward such absurd stories that it makes your ears ache without a shred of probability. General, remember the Siege of Kars. And let me tell you, gentlemen, that my story is the unvarnished truth. I will only observe that every reality, even though it has its unalterable laws, is almost always difficult to believe and improbable, and sometimes, indeed, the more real it is, the more improbable it is."
"But could he eat 60 monks?
They asked, laughing round him.
"Well, he didn't eat them all at once, that's evident. But if he consumed them in the course of 15 or 20 years... it is perfectly comprehensible and natural."
"Natural?"
"Yes, natural,"
Lebedev repeated, with pedantic persistence.
"Besides, a Catholic monk is, from his very nature, easily led and inquisitive, and it wouldn't be hard to lure him into the forest, or to some hidden place, and there to deal with him, as aforesaid. But I don't deny that the number of persons devoured seems excessive to the point of greediness."
"It may be true, gentlemen," observed Mushkin suddenly. Till then he had listened in silence to the disputants, and had taken no part in the conversation. He had often joined heartily in the general outbursts of laughter. He was evidently delighted that they were so gay and so noisy, even that they were drinking so much. He might perhaps not have uttered a word the whole evening,
but suddenly he seemed moved to speak. He spoke with marked gravity, so that everyone turned to him at once with interest. "What I mean, gentlemen, is that famines used to be frequent. I have heard of that, though I know little history, but I think they must have been. When I was among the Swiss mountains, I was surprised at the ruins of feudal castles, built on the mountain slopes or precipitous rocks at least half a mile high, which means some miles of mountain path. You know what a castle is, a perfect mountain of stones. They must have meant an awful, incredible labour, and of course they were all built by the poor people, the vassals, besides which they had to pay all the taxes and support the priesthood. How could they provide for themselves and till the land? They must have been few in number at that time. They died off terribly from famine, and there may have been literally nothing to eat. I've sometimes wondered, indeed, how it was that the people didn't become extinct altogether, how it was that nothing happened to them, and how they managed to endure it and survive. No doubt Lebediev is right in saying that there were cannibals, and perhaps many of them. Only, I don't understand why he brought monks into the story, and what he means by that. Probably because in the 12th century it was only the monks who were fit to eat, because they were the only people that were fat, observed Gavril Ardalionovitch.
A magnificent and true idea, cried Lebediev. Seeing he didn't touch laymen, not one layman to 60 ecclesiastics, and that's a frightful thought, an historical thought. A statistical thought, indeed, and such facts make history for one who understands, for it follows with arithmetical exactitude that the ecclesiastics lived at least 60 times as happily and comfortably as all the rest of mankind at that period, and perhaps they were at least 60 times as fat.
An exaggeration! An exaggeration, Lebediev! They all laughed.
I agree that is an historical thought, but what are you leading up to?
Mushkin inquired again. He spoke with such gravity and so absolutely without mocking or jeering at Lebediev, at whom all the rest were laughing, that in contrast with the general tone, his words could not help sounding comic. They were almost on the verge of laughing at him, but he did not notice it.
"And don't you see, Prince, that he's a madman?" said Yevgeny Pavlovich, bending down to him. "I was told here just now that he's mad on being a lawyer and making lawyer's speeches, and wants to go in for an examination. I'm expecting a glorious burlesque."
"I am leading up to vast issues," Lebediev was roaring meanwhile. "But let us first of all analyse the psychological and legal position of the criminal. We see that the criminal, or as I might call him, my client, in spite of the impossibility of finding any other comestible, several times in the course of his interesting career showed signs of a desire to repent and shun the clergy. We see this clearly from the facts. It will be remembered that he did at any rate consume 5 or 6 infants, a number relatively insignificant, yet remarkable from another point of view. It is evident that, tormented by terrible pangs of conscience, for my client is a religious man and conscientious, as I shall prove later, and to minimise his sin as far as possible, he, by way of experiment, changed his diet from the clergy to the laity. That it was by way of experiment is beyond doubt again, for had it been simply for the sake of gastronomic variety, the number 6 would be too insignificant. Why only 6? Why not 30? Half of one and half of the other. But if it were only an experiment, arising simply from despair and the fear of sacrilege and of offending the church, the number 6 becomes quite intelligible. For 6 attempts to appease the pangs of conscience are more than enough, as the attempts could not but be unsuccessful. And in the first place, in my opinion, an infant is too small. That is, insufficient, so that he would need 3 times or 5 times as many infant laymen for the same period of time as one ecclesiastic. So that the sin, though less on the one side, would be greater on the other, not in quality, but in quantity. In this reflection, gentlemen, I am, of course, entering into the feelings of a criminal of the 12th century. As for me, a man of the 19th century, I should have reasoned differently, I beg to inform you. So you need not grin at me, gentlemen, and it's not at all the thing for you to do, General. In the second place, an infant, in my opinion, would be not sufficiently nutritious, and perhaps too sweet and mawkish, so that his appetite would be unsatisfied, while the pangs of conscience would remain. Now, for the conclusion, the finale, gentlemen, in which lies the solution of one of the greatest questions of that age and of this. The criminal ends by going and giving information against himself to the clergy, and gives himself up to the authorities. One wonders what tortures awaited him in that age. The wheel, the stake, and the fire. Who was it urged him to go and inform against himself? Why not simply stop short at 60 and keep the secret till his dying breath? Why not simply relinquish the clergy and live in penitence as a hermit? Why not indeed enter a monastery himself? Here is the solution. There must have been something stronger than stake and fire, stronger even than the habit of 20 years. There must have been an idea stronger than any misery, famine, torture, plague, leprosy, and all that hell which mankind could not have endured without that idea, which bound men together, guided their hearts, and fructified the springs of life. Show me anything like such a force in our age of vices and railways. I should say of steamers and railways, but I say vices and railways because I'm drunk, but truthful. Show me any idea binding mankind together today with anything like the power it had in those centuries, and dare to tell me that the springs of life have not been weakened and muddied beneath the star, beneath the network in which men are enmeshed. And don't try to frighten me with your prosperity, your wealth, the infrequency of famine, and the rapidity of the means of communication. There is more wealth, but there is less strength. There is no uniting idea. Everything has grown softer. Everything is limp, and everyone is limp. We've all of us grown limp. Well, that's enough. That's not the point now. The point is, honoured prince, whether we shouldn't see to get in the supper that's being prepared for your visitors.
Lebediev had roused several of his hearers to positive indignation. It must be noted that corks were being drawn incessantly all the time. But his unexpected reference to supper conciliated all his opponents at once. He called such a conclusion a smart, lawyer-like wind-up. Good-humoured laughter rang out again. The guests grew more festive, and they all got up from the table to stretch their legs and make a turn on the veranda. Only Keller was still displeased with Lebediev's speech, and was much excited.
"He attacks enlightenment, and upholds the bigotry of the 12th century. He's attitudinizing. It's not through simple-heartedness. How did he himself come by this house, allow me to ask?" he said aloud, appealing to each and all.
"I used to know a real interpreter of the apocalypse," the general was saying in another corner to another group of listeners, among them Titsin, whom he had buttonholed. "The late Grigory Semyonovich Bemistrov. He used to make your heart glow. First he'd put on his spectacles and open a big old book in a black leather binding, and he'd a grey beard and 2 medals in recognition of his munificent charities. He used to begin sternly and severely. Generals would bow down before him, and ladies fell into swoons. But this fellow winds up with supper. It's beyond anything."
Titsin listened to the general, smiled and made towards his hat, as though meaning to go, but seemed to be undecided, or to have forgotten his intention. Ganya had left off drinking and pushed away his glass, even before they got up from the table. A shade of gloom came over his face. When they rose from the table, he went up to Rogozhin and sat down beside him. They might have been supposed to be on the friendliest terms. Rogozhin, who had also at first been several times on the point of getting up and slipping away, sat now motionless with his head bowed. He too seemed to have forgotten his intention. He had not drunk a drop of wine all the evening, and was very thoughtful. From time to time he raised his eyes and gazed at everyone. It might have been supposed that he was expecting something of great importance to him, and had made up his mind to wait for it. Mushkin had drunk no more than 2 or 3 glasses, and was only light-hearted. As he rose from the table, he caught the eye of Yevgeny Pavlovich. He remembered the explanation they were to have, and smiled cordially. Yevgeny Pavlovich nodded to him and indicated Ippolit, whom he was intently watching at the moment.
Ippolit was asleep at full length on the sofa.
"Tell me, Prince, why has this wretched boy forced himself upon you?" he asked suddenly, with such undisguised annoyance and even malice that Mushkin was surprised. "I'll bet he's got some mischief in his mind."
"I have noticed," said Mushkin. "I have fancied, at any rate, that he is in your thoughts a great deal today, Yevgeny Pavlovich, isn't he?"
"And you may say, too, I've enough to think about in my own position, so that I'm surprised myself at not being able to get away from that detestable countenance all the evening."
"He has a handsome face."
"Look! Look!" cried Yevgeny Pavlovich, pulling Mushkin by the arm. "Look!"
Mushkin gazed at Yevgeny Pavlovich with wonder again.